I'd like to introduce James Gray. He is director and co-writer of the film Two Lovers, which is screening at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, nice to be here.
I have to say, I love this movie, and I've really been looking forward to talking to you about it. It's based on a Dostoevsky story called White Nights, but it's set in Brooklyn in the present. How did you come across the story? What inspired you to make that into a film?
Well, you know, it's funny because you're saying that, and you're right. I mean, and that's what I've been saying, but what's really more true is that it's sort of a combination of several different things. It's not really, it's sort of inspired by the Dostoevsky. What exactly happened is that, you know, I wish I could say that a story comes at you like a big lightning bolt and all of a sudden you've got the whole thing, but what's much more accurate, at least for me, is that you get a detail here and a detail there, and then all of a sudden the story begins to come from that. And I had been reading a bunch of different stories, sort of looking for an interesting thing to talk about desire. And I came across that. I guess I was after a little light reading. I pulled the Dostoevsky off my shelf. Why not? A few laughs.
Right, right.
And I had not read it in 20 years. I think I'd read it in college and sort of leafed through it. And the story seemed kind of beautiful to me, very simple. And it had at its core a very interesting main character who was kind of had a slight, you know, sort of a mental illness about him, which I guess if, you know, Dostoevsky had been writing today, the main character would have been taking all host of pharmaceuticals, but back then was just considered a little off. And I thought it was a perfect way to make a film about desire and sexual attraction because he's just a little bit more exaggerated than we are in his behavior. So that's really where the whole thing sort of began.
And it's interesting because this man, Leonard, who is played by Joaquin Phoenix, is taking all sorts of pharmaceuticals, and he's still a little off.
Well, yes, of course, as we know, they aren't perfect. But also, what I was trying to say was that, really, in a way, we are all kind of crazy when we think we're in love. I mean, we do totally infantile things.
Right.
I mean, you could be a 50-year-old person and, you know, call someone that you are attracted to, and the person starts speaking, and you hang up the phone. I mean, you know what I mean? We all do insane things. So I wanted to make a film in which a person was kind of just at the edge of being what we might call sane, to really hopefully kind of show what we can all be like in that state.
It's interesting because he's a young, not so young, 30-something, I guess, man who moves, his engagement has fallen apart for reasons that are nobody's fault. He moves back to his parents' place in Brooklyn. They're an older Jewish immigrant couple who run a dry cleaning business, and he really is being kind of led to go into a marriage with the daughter of an associate of his father's, and to replicate a kind of stable and good marriage, which is a kind of romance or marriage of the previous generation. And that's one template, which probably many of us know, and then there's this other, which is the vivacious, gorgeous, and sort of slightly crazy character played by Gwyneth Paltrow, who shows up in his life.
Right. I think that's pretty fair. That's a pretty fair way to summarize it. I mean, it's maybe a little schematic, you know, in the way that the film has been conceived, but you know, sometimes life is a little schematic, and sometimes we're faced with particular options, or maybe we're faced with no options, and we have great pressures to behave and great pressures to fit in. So I was trying to explain a world for this character that essentially established basic choices for him.
And what I guess what I love about the film, well, many things, but one of the things is the writing is so good that there's not a single cliche that I could find anywhere in it. Maybe the way we're talking about it here on the radio, some people would say, oh yeah, the modern romantic versus the stable, you know, previous generation. But what you have in it is actually very real people living day to day and confronting, as you say, desire and what seems like love. You're not even sure what you can call it, whether it's love or not, and it leaves the listener or the viewer with this question, what is love really? And I like that about the film, is that at the end you really don't quite know what to think. Your questions aren't really answered at all.
Well, I appreciate you saying that very much. I thank you for that. I mean, look, one of the things that I've always wanted to do was to try and make a film in which the ending in particular, but the whole film really could be read in one of two different ways. That there was, because I think that's like life, you know, life is bittersweet. It's. I mean, if you make a movie or if you write a book or do anything really that has an upbeat ending, for example, then people will quite rightly often regard it as phony. And if it's a downbeat ending, people will quite rightly often regard it as over the top or gratuitous. So what you're trying to do is say, in life, there's not something that is the answer. There is a certain ambiguity. In other words, it's not vague. You know what's actually happening in the story, but it's ambiguous in that it could be read one of two ways, because I feel like that's life. And in the attempt to attack the notion of cliché, you're always dealing with some measure of cliché, because cliché is the ugly flip side of archetype. But archetype is good. Archetype can be embraced, should be embraced, because that's what, frankly, gives its kind of universality. The cliché comes when the details are hackneyed. So I try to alter the details or make the movie as specific as possible. And that's the way I tried to attack it.
I think the Gwyneth Paltrow character is interesting because it's a great portrayal of a character who, a woman, the kind of woman who gets a lot of attention. She's got a lot of problems, and she finds a kind of false self-esteem in being wildly attractive to all kinds of men, but then she doesn't know how to deal with the consequences when they fall in love with her. I know her. Everybody knows her. And there she is, perfectly portrayed in this film.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Gwyneth. You know, I find that sometimes it's easy to kind of consider that type of performing very easy or something. I think it would be very dangerous to do that, and I think she walks the line incredibly well. I mean, she understood it about that character very clearly. The idea that in a way, entirely what is presented, you know, the superficial aspects of who we are, is so often the only thing that's accepted, even by the most, what we think are the most evolved among us. I mean, look, I love my wife. She's fantastic, you know. But if I had met her at a party, and if I had seen her at this party, and she were, for example, wearing too much makeup or dressed differently, it's possible I never would have talked to her. Now, I don't regard myself, I don't think, as a totally superficial jerk, but that, in a way, is a superficial evaluation of even someone like my wife. So Gwyneth was very aware of the sort of superficial or physical aspects of the character, and trying to show that the person underneath constantly has to grapple with these people tugging for her affection based totally on the surface. And she really got it. I mean, I was great to work with her.
And every character, every actor in this movie really got it. And I was wondering how you cast them. Were you casting for chemistry between and among the various characters?
Well, I wrote it pretty much I wrote it for Joaquin Phoenix, and I wrote it for Gwyneth. If Joaquin didn't want to do it, I wouldn't have made the film. It was a very small movie, made very quickly, and it was made right before the strike, you know, the writer's strike stopped all production. And I kind of said to Joaquin, look, I'd like to go off and make this movie very quickly. Are you interested? And if you're not, I'll just shelve it. And he said, no, it's great. I'd love to do it. And so he came aboard. And in a way, the whole picture exists because of Gwyneth, because one of the things that she said to me several years ago, actually, and it planted the seed in my brain, she said, you know, she said she wasn't going to act very much. She wanted to raise her children. And she said, well, besides, why does that matter to you? You only make movies, you know, about guys with guns. You know, I had known her socially for many years, and I sort of thought about that, and I said, well, really? The only movies I make, guys with guns? I got to fix that in your mind. Mm-hmm. So I always felt that I owed the movie to Joaquin and to Gwyneth in a way. And as for the other characters, I simply cast them with an eye towards some sense of verisimilitude versus breaking apart the stereotype, you know, which is why I went to Isabella Rossellini as Joaquin's mother. I didn't want the kind of stereotypical, you know, obese, loudmouthed Jewish mom who was a complete nag and really loud, you know, Leonard, do me a favor and pick up right. your dirty laundry. You know, I didn't want that. I wanted someone who was had a certain tenderness and a real emotion and a reality to the person, you know, and frankly, a lot like my mother was. And that's why I cast her, you know. So it goes on a case-by-case basis, really, how you cast the picture.
You do a wonderful job. By the way, we're talking about the film Two Lovers, which is screening at the CCA in Santa Fe, the Center for Contemporary Arts. You do a wonderful job of creating discomfort in the viewer. You can't stop watching it, but you're on pins and needles as the Joaquin Phoenix character, Leonard, is ditching Sandra for this beautiful Michelle. You don't know how it's going to end, and it made me wonder, just on the level of craft, how do you do that? How do you make us, who are watching, so very tense?
Well, I'm very glad you felt that way. I suppose it's just a matter of what you might call, planting and payoff. I mean, narrative is very tricky because it's always about context. You know, you're telling a story. You know, I've made films where in the dailies, you know, when you shoot the scene, on the day that you shoot it, you think, well, that's the best scene I've ever shot in my life. And you go home and you feel all good about yourself. And then you watch the footage in the span of the film, and the scene doesn't make any sense. And what you find very, very soon when you begin to make a film is always that narrative is about context, figuring out how moment A will somehow lead to moment B, and so on. This is a very tricky idea and a very tricky concept. And, I mean, it's exasperating. I guess what I can only say is that if you felt that tension, it's really a product, hopefully, of a kind of ability to add A plus B plus C and have it add up to something. I mean, I know that sounds a little reductionist, but it's a very difficult thing to really get your hands on, which is really the principle of storytelling itself.
The cinematography really is in service of the film and doesn't draw too much attention to itself. What was your role in directing the cinematographer?
Well, I tend to be, I mean, certain directors, every director works differently with every cinematographer. The way I work tends to be extremely specific, you know, where I put the camera, how it moves, what the lens is on the camera. And I sort of tell the director of photography that's exactly where I want the shot to be. And then I have a dialogue with the director of photography. And he either gives me another idea if he doesn't like it and says, this might be better, and I either say yes or no. Or he tries to improve upon what it is that I had originally in mind. And I always like to listen to what the director of photography has to say, because that's why they're there. They're better at their job than you are. So most of the time, you know, there'll be a debate. And, of course, you know, it's not a democracy on the set, so the director always wins. But really the dialogue is mostly about, on this film in particular, was mostly about not having the style of the film be the statement. That we would always try and be deceptively simple. Now, to make a film that looks simple, by the way, is the farthest thing from simple you could imagine.
Right.
But we were trying to always take a step backward and say, if the audience is conscious of how the camera is moving, for example, or where the camera is, then we've done something wrong. But what we're actually trying to do is make a very simple story with a very simple through line, but nonetheless incredibly ambiguous and something that exists really as a kind of almost like a fable in a way. Now, it doesn't mean it's pitched as a fable, but when you're trying to do this kind of thing, which to me is the most pure thing that movies can do and can be, then it's your job to try and conceive of something that will work unconsciously on the audience, but of course you have to conceive of it consciously. It's the greatest single challenge in movie making.
Right. I think it would be a very good movie for students of film to watch for precisely that reason, because the first time you watch it, you're so caught up in the story and so wondering what's going to happen, and you're feeling all the emotions of the characters, and because you're not really aware of the craft of the cinematography, unless you're already, very attuned to that kind of thing, then the second and third time around, you could really begin to discover the techniques that you use to create all those effects inside of us.
Well, one of the things that we really discussed at length, the director of photography and I, and the actors too, was that we didn't want to create a movie where the audience could distance itself from the experience. In other words, we didn't want it to be like one of those movies where you could almost watch the characters under glass, and you could say, look at them, look how stupid they are, or look what they're doing, or laugh at them, or sneer at them.
Right.
We wanted to make it so that the experience would be that everything they are doing, we totally understand, and the movie loves them for all their flaws. And when you're doing that, it's very, this is the major reason why we used this strategy, is to say, essentially, style is incredibly important in the movie. But it's style always in service of character and always in service of story, meaning that it would never overwhelm any of the elements that we just discussed. So if you're watching a movie that is incredibly stylish, and you're aware of that on first viewing, then it means there's less accent paid, or less attention, I should say, paid to performance, or often less attention paid to story, which to me slightly diminishes the movie-going experience. In this
right.
sense, I must say I'm a little bit old school.
Well, I think it precisely succeeds in what you were talking about and what you were trying to do. I was thinking recently about the difference between a film or a novel and real life. And in a right. film or a novel, all sorts of people have characters that are very realistic, and the landscape is realistic, and the setting, and all of that. But a plot is established, loose ends are tied up, and you have an ending where you, on some level, have a sense of satisfaction that you know how things are. And in real life, we bumble along, and one thing happens, and another thing happens, and loose ends are rarely tied up, and when they are, it feels like you're living a novel, but that's not what usually happens. And I think what was so interesting about this film is, although, as you say, it's clear what happens in the end, you don't know what kind of an ending it is. And I found myself speculating, what's going to be the life of each of these people in 5 years? What kind of bombs are going to explode? What are they, you know, are X and Y going to be happy? Are they going to be at each other's throats? Are they going to be together? Are they not going to be together? And you truly don't know. And in that sense, on some level, although it works very well as a plot, it has a little bit more of that sense of real life.
Well, it was certainly. I appreciate that. You know, you felt that way. I mean, it's certainly what we tried to do. What you're talking about is a kind of. Many people have said this to me at question and answer sessions and so forth. You know, they'd said, "I wonder what happens to the people in 5 years." You know, the ending is what you might call an open ending, where really there's so many different possibilities for the characters. I have really stole that idea from a fantastic movie made by Federico Fellini in 1957, a movie he did called The Knights of Cabiria, which has an amazingly open ending. And you could read it about 30 different ways, and you wonder what happens to the main character 10, 20, 30 years hence. It's really kind of an amazing thing. And what you find is that the movie becomes, I mean, I'm not saying this is what I did, but it's certainly what Fellini did, is the ending becomes completely timeless, and it seems to live on. It seems to have a life of its own, and it's really a thing of beauty. And if you can pull that off, I think it's really the greatest reward you can give an audience. And it's really treating the audience, in my view, with respect. Because what you're saying is this is something that should be thought about after and long after it's been made. It's not like an instantly digestible thing. It's not fast food, you know, that you just sort of get rid of and very quickly you just forget about it. This is something
right.
that you hopefully will contemplate. And say, well, this side of the coin, and then there's this side of the coin. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was the ambition.
Yeah, well, very successfully done. James Gray is the director and co-writer of the film Two Lovers, which is screening at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. Linda Siegel will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned.